From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. When fatal plane crashes, mass shootings, or terrorist attacks take place, they make major headlines and sow fear in the public. But what most of us don't realize is that we have a much greater risk of injury and death in the workplace than we do, say, while flying. The U.S. government has spent billions on counterterrorism measures and comparably little on making our workplaces safer. Yet thousands of Americans die in the workplace each year and millions are injured. Now a new book, harkening back to Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, lays bare the overlooked dangers that lead to injuries and deaths in the American workplace. Injuries and deaths that are often preventable. My guest is Jonathan Carmel, attorney with expertise in labor and employment law, a fellow of the College of Labor and Employment Lawyers, and co-chair of the American Bar Association's Occupational Safety and Health Committee. He joins me now to discuss his new book, Dying to Work, Death and Injury in the American Workplace. Welcome to the program, John.
Thank you for having me this afternoon.
Thanks so much for joining us. So we live in a country where these dangers are essentially overlooked. If you have a conversation around it, it usually seems like a problem that we have solved. You know, when Upton Sinclair published his book, The Jungle, it drew attention to it. We had the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, and then we got smart and we passed laws and we fixed the situation, and now it's a minimal issue. But that's not true, is it?
It isn't true. There are upwards of 5,000 workers each year who are killed on the job, and more than 3 million who are injured on the job. And those are just the reported numbers, and there's a lot of underreporting. So it's not a problem that is solved at all. It continues in different ways as the workplace has changed in the 50 years since OSHA was enacted.
How are those numbers increasing? Are we seeing greater and greater numbers of deaths and injuries every year?
Since the time I've been researching in the last 6 years or more, the numbers of deaths, again, reported deaths from on-the-job incidents, have remained around 5,000 workers each year, give or take a few on either side. But there are 50,000 workers, 50,000 to 60,000 workers who die each year from work-related illnesses and exposures, including coal miners who are still suffering from silicosis, black lung disease. So altogether, that's not part of the 5,000. There's an additional 50 to 60,000 workers who die as a result of workplace exposures.
Let's talk a little bit about history. We have had some terrible mass deaths and injuries in the U.S.'s past. Mentioned Sinclair's The Jungle, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory. We've had coal miners and railroad workers who historically, decades ago, worked under very poorly regulated conditions. And eventually, through concerted effort, mostly worker-led, grassroots, union-led efforts, we had laws that passed. I mean, today we most notably think about OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration Act. Tell us a little bit about how that transpired, how that came about.
OSHA was finally enacted in 1970, and of all presidents, Richard Nixon signed it into law. But it took years before OSHA became a comprehensive national piece of legislation. So before that, we didn't have any comprehensive national legislation. There was legislation regulating the mine industry, which is separate from OSHA even today. Hmm. But for all other private sector workers, there was no national legislation. It was all on a kind of an ad hoc basis, depending on what state you lived in and what kind of state laws that they had regulating workplace hazards. But, you know, it always takes workers' deaths before there's any real activity in this area.
So what does OSHA require private industry to do, and is it being properly enforced?
So OSHA is a regulatory statute, and what I mean by that is that the preamble, if you will, or Section 5A1, to be real technical, the statute requires employers to provide their workers with safe workplaces, safe and healthy workplaces. And how they do that is they have to identify actual workplace hazards within a particular workplace or workplaces. And then they can develop regulations and rules on how to avoid workplace injuries from that hazard. But if you don't have a regulation identifying and regulating a particular hazard, there are still, and there are, thousands and thousands of workplace hazards that are unregulated. And as a result, workers who get injured or worse, get killed, the employer cannot be held accountable, generally speaking, for those injuries or deaths if they're not a regulated hazard.
So you essentially, we have a law in place, but it's clearly inadequate. Are there statistics that the United States provides, government keeps track of? We have the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Does it keep track of these workplace injuries, and are these a proper accounting, or are they also sort of an undercount?
So employers are required to report certain kinds of workplace injuries and, of course, deaths. They don't always report it. There's a lot of underreporting going on. And so the statistics that the government reports is from the information that the government receives from compliant employers who report these injuries or they report these deaths. But because they're underreporting and many aren't reporting, the numbers aren't as reliable as we would like them to be. And reporting is a really important part of workplace safety regulation, because we know of unsafe work conditions and unsafe and workplace hazards by virtue of how they're being reported from the industry. So if there's one or two injuries from a particular local hazard, it might not be something that needs to be regulated. But if there's all sorts of injuries and deaths occurring from a particular hazard across many different work sites and workplaces, then that identifies to experts and OSHA that hazard needs to be regulated and remedied or remediated and to get rid of that.
What are the most dangerous occupations in the country today? We can think of coal miners and railroad workers, poultry workers. Has that changed? Do we see workplaces that we might not think of as being dangerous to our health today that are among the most dangerous ones?
The government, the Bureau of Labor Standards, has they list what are the most dangerous workplaces. But they do it based on a metric, a measurement, based on the number of workers who work in that industry and how many are getting hurt. So, but I would say, and you know, others would agree, that the most dangerous industries in general are construction, obviously offshore workers who work in offshore oil platforms, but there are dangerous industries all over the place, and that was sort of, that was the point of one of the reasons I wrote the book, is I wanted to explain to the readers that virtually every workplace has hazards and virtually every workplace can cause an injury or a death. And so I highlighted and wrote stories about workplaces that we wouldn't ordinarily think about as being dangerous, but they are. And I talk about grocery stores and hotels and nurses, and other workplaces that we come into contact with every day. Most of us don't come into contact with coal miners down in a coal mine, but we come into contact with grocery store workers all the time. And that's a dangerous job. But yet, as it was for me, you know, parents send their children to go work in a grocery store. It's a good job for a 16-year-old, but it's a dangerous job.
Speaking of grocery stores, and tell us about the story of Hannah, who worked at a Kroger's that you profile in your book, just to give us an example.
So Hannah Phillips at the time was a young woman who was in high school, and she started working at a Kroger grocery store in Indiana, and she eventually got moved into working in their meat department. The workers in the meat department wear, as we probably all have seen, these white, they almost look like lab coats to protect their clothing from, you know, blood and meat juices and what have you. And Hannah was a small, petite young girl, and so the coats didn't fit her very well. In any event, at the end of the day, she was assigned by herself to clean the machinery in the back of the in the meat department, grinders and saws and all those dangerous equipment. And while Hannah was reaching her hand in to pull out a piece of gristle that was stuck in the throat of a meat grinder that she believed was turned off, the grinder caught the cuff of her coat, which was too big for her, pulled her arm in, and she pulled it out a moment later, and her arm was gone up to her elbow. And it's a horrible story. She's a brave, brave young girl, now a woman, adult woman, and she wrapped the shredded coat around the stump of her arm, walked to the front of the store, and calmly said, "Please call an ambulance." And she now has, she's lost her arm because the meat grinder, someone overrode the safety switch on it, which would have prevented it from being turned on. And Hannah didn't know about it, and she lost her arm in a preventable incident.
So what about the kinds of responses to these sorts of accidents from employers, from private industry? When you have a situation like this that sort of happens on an individual basis, one might imagine that it's seen as an anomaly. But then you have workplaces where masses of people can get killed. You mentioned offshore drilling, like the BP accident where a number of workers got killed. There was the Massey Energy accident in West Virginia about a decade ago where nearly 30 coal miners were killed. Do you find that industry takes greater action when you have those sorts of dramatic accidents?
Well, there's an old saying in the coal mining industry that coal mine safety laws are only enacted after coal miners die. And often what happens, not just in coal mining, but in other industries. But regulations or regulating a workplace hazard is not an easy fix because there's a lot of opposition to regulations, as we know in this country. We have an anti-regulatory fever that has been around since Ronald Reagan certainly was president. And as a result, to get a single regulation through enacted into a rule or a standard, it could take on average 7 years. Some of them well-known workplace hazards have taken 18 to 20 years to regulate a single workplace hazard. So the regulatory process is broken, and as a result, there's huge gaps in the protections for workers in holding, in identifying workplace hazards and holding employers who don't follow the protocols and doesn't hold these employers accountable for these injuries and deaths.
So, John, let's go to this issue of how we are seeing a deregulatory period today. I mean, the Trump administration has been feverishly working to unfetter corporations even more than they are already. We also have a shift in employment practices in the United States today, with more and more Americans being forced into the so-called gig economy, part-time work, temporary work, which is often incredibly low paid, doesn't come with benefits, and I imagine even less regulated than those workplaces that offer full-time work. Do these changes have a greater impact on workplace, on worker health in the workplace?
Sure. As I said a little bit earlier, our work, the American workplaces and the types of workers and the types of jobs that are being done today are much different than they were being, than they were 50 years ago when OSHA was enacted. So there's a, yet OSHA hasn't been reformed and updated in the way that would take into account for the changes in the types of work being done and the number of workers being done and who is doing that work. And you mentioned the gig economy. I mean, there's it's an unregulated industry in a number of ways, including workplace safety, part-time workers, temporary workers, workers who come from work agencies. They're really vulnerable because, as I write in the book, these workers are often the ones who are asked to do the most dangerous jobs. If they're not my workers, but I bring them in from an outside agency, I'm in some places, as an employer, not responsible for their workplace injuries or deaths. I don't have to pay workers' compensation benefits or premiums for their injuries or their deaths. So we so employers often assign these most dangerous jobs to these temporary workers. So there are so many gaps in the protection in workplace protections for workers that it's they're virtually unprotected in my view.
So what about unions and the power of unions to speak up on this issue? I mean, we've also, of course, seen a big decline in unions over many years, although there seems to be some greater union activity over the past couple of years in certain industries or certain sectors. Are unions often a place where those workers who suffer from injuries feel that they might have a greater say to affect change? Do unions emphasize workplace safety alongside, you know, other issues of wages and benefits?
They do, and the statistics and studies show that unionized workplaces, while not completely free of workplace hazards or free of workplace injuries, are much safer on a whole than non-unionized workplaces. And there's a lot of reasons for that. One of them is, you know, unions, many unions have robust health and safety committees. They'll negotiate health and safety rules, so we don't have to rely on the regulatory process in Washington to get workplace protections. So for all those reasons, plus including the reason that you have union who oversee this, so when a worker gets injured, they can go to the employer and demand that that hazard, that workplace hazard that caused an injury or death, gets fixed in a way that non-union workers don't have that voice and don't have that power.
So what do you, as a lawyer working on these issues, want to see happen? I mean, you've written a book where you, this a culmination of your personal interaction with many, many people who've suffered horrendous, debilitating injuries in the workplace. So you've seen up front and close the human cost of not enough safety measures. Many of these injuries are quite preventable. But industries, it's a big country, there are many industries, and of course lawmakers are always worried about costs and too many regulations and stifling innovation. As a lawyer working on this issue, what would you like to see?
Well, I'd like to see, first of all, Americans as a whole, people who go to work every day and come home safe, but they have to become aware. And I talk about that in the book. In order to affect social change, or any change, you have to become aware of the problem. And there are too many of us in America today who go to work, don't think of being injured or worse, until it happens to them or happens to a coworker or happens to a family member. And unfortunately, when, it's too late then. So we all have to understand the magnitude of the problem and then demand some action and response from our politicians. And I talk about enacting local legislation, kind of putting OSHA to the side a little bit and saying we can, most politics, as they say, is local. Let's try and fix things locally. Local may be the city of Chicago or might be my small community, that I live in a small town. But insist upon workplace safety standards in your community. And it's happening in this country. In a lot of ways, outside of OSHA. The other thing we have to do is we have to create a real meaningful safety net for workers when they get injured or their surviving family members when their loved one gets killed. Right now, all we have is workers' compensation. And
Which, of
it's.
course, corporations can just fold in as a cost of doing business.
They could do it as a cost of doing business. And our workers' compensation system is a broken system. It's not what it was intended to be when labor and capital got together at the end of the at the beginning of the last century and said, we got to make this bargain. You workers and labor, you won't sue us in the courts, and in exchange, we'll provide you with benefits when you get injured. We'll provide you with wage loss benefits, disability benefits and medical benefits. And so it was supposed to be an exchange, quid pro quo, if you will. Now it's a very litigious system. So when a worker gets obviously hurt and it's a job related injury, they have to go in many cases through this very litigious workers' compensation system, go and hire a lawyer. In the meantime, they're not getting benefits, they're not getting wage benefits, they're not getting their medical bills paid. They're dealing, fighting with insurance companies and insurance company lawyers. And it's an awful process to go through. So we have to fix the workers' compensation system and make it a national system rather than this crazy quilt of 50 different systems in 50 different states.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, John. Good luck with the book.
Thank you so much for having me this afternoon.
My guest is Jonathan Carmel, attorney with expertise in labor and employment law, a fellow of the College of Labor and Employer Lawyers, and co-chair of the American Bar Association's Occupational Safety and Health Committee. We've been discussing his new book, Dying to Work: Death and Injury in the American Workplace. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.